April 13th, 2005. If we're quite ready, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2754.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. House Bill 2754 is creating the Oregon Center for Health, health professions within the Department of Higher Education and will be administered by the Oregon Institute of Technology. You will notice behind you, this has a subsequently throw to Ways and Means. You will notice you have a dash one amendment. I am also passing out that dash one amendment hand in gross because I believe that people will be speaking to that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sandy. Representative Garrard, I invite you forward. And did you want to bring some people with you?
Oh,
Senator Whitson. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Bill Garrard. I am a state representative from District 56, Klamath Falls. And I'm here with Senator Whitson, also from district we represent, and the president of Oregon Institute of Technology, Martha Ann Dow. Having been a former member of this committee, this is the bill that you really enjoy looking forward to. It's a dream bill because it's a win-win bill. I don't know why we have a referral to Ways and Means because I'm not aware that this is going to require any funds authorized by the committee, nor is the bill asking for any funds. So we'll have to check with the chair after that. But it's there is no question that as if you have sat here for month after month and week after week and see the needs that are in the future for health care, not only in Oregon but in this entire country. We're bringing before you this morning is a concept, an idea that will create through higher education more technicians, more nurses, more healthcare professionals. And to tell you more about this concept and the excitement, I'll refer to my good colleague, Senator Whitson.
Chair Dolfo and committee members, thank you for the opportunity here to testify for House Bill 2754 for the record. I'm Doug Whitson, Senator from 2754. Never in our history has a greater demand existed for allied health care professionals. Our population is aging, and as we baby boomers reach retirement age and beyond, this demand will increase at near exponential proportions. The demand for allied health professionals will parallel this exponential expansion. OIT is currently our state leader in the education of these allied health care professionals. The school programs in nursing, dental hygiene, nutrition, ultrasonography, nuclear imaging, vascular imaging and technology, magnetic resonance imaging, and all other means of medical technical professionalism. Each program is constrained by the same common denominators. Each program has several times as many qualified programs as capacity to educate. And each program has several times as many requests for graduating students as the school has capacity to produce. OIT has completed a building design, has established industry partners, and is developing an innovative private sector funding initiative to position itself to fill this gaping void in our state's ability to educate our needed allied healthcare professionals. OIT President Martha Ann Dow has recognized the need, developed a staff with expertise, and has demonstrated the desire and the ability to lead this state in the education of allied healthcare professionals. Oregon Institute of Technology is the logical choice. Creating the Oregon Center for Health Professionals at OIT is the first giant step in the right direction. I urge you to move this bill to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I obviously should be to the House floor with a two-pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Martha Andel, president of Oregon Institute of Technology, and obviously I'm here today also to speak about House Bill 2754 and to answer any questions you might have about that bill. I also want to thank Senator Whitsitt and Representative Bill Garrard and Representative Gilman for their support and endorsement of this bill. Oregon Institute of Technology has more than 50 years of experience graduating allied healthcare professionals, and this expertise combined with the critical shortage in healthcare professionals in Oregon and actually in the Pacific Northwest set the stage for this legislation. As you have previously heard, there's no funding related to the bill, but its potential to help OIT meet its goals is tremendous. This bill, House Bill 2754, including the amendments that are currently being considered that clarify our intentions, designates OIT as the leading Oregon resource for these educational programs and gives us significant credibility as we pursue other avenues of funding. A handout that is attached to my written testimony helps describe in detail how OIT plans to address this workforce shortage in the next 5 years. This plan has been 3 years in the making, and it is based on strengthening and developing partnerships with other educational institutions, with leaders in the healthcare industry, and with the manufacturers and providers of high-tech medical equipment. OIT takes seriously its mission to provide this kind of education for Oregon, and that's why this bill is so important to us. Currently, we are the only public university in Oregon that offers bachelor's degree programs in dental hygiene, health science, and medical imaging, including radiology science, nuclear medicine, sonography, and vascular technology. While these programs are offered in Klamath Falls, the dental hygiene program is also offered in partnership with Oregon Dental Services and Eastern Oregon University in LeGrand. And many of these programs offer bachelor's degree completion degrees through distance learning. Oregon Health Science University's nursing program is also delivered at OIT in Klamath Falls. Through partnerships with other institutions, OIT also offers joint degrees with OHSU in the clinical lab science and emergency medical technology disciplines in Portland. And most recently, we have developed and are offering a respiratory care program with Rogue Community College in Medford. While there exists a need for qualified allied health personnel in the workforce, educational institutions at this time lack the capacity, laboratories, equipment, and faculty to provide this need. OIT alone turns away 300 students each year because of lack of capacity, and this is incredible in light of the shortage in the workforce. So, as Oregon's leader in providing public bachelor-level allied health education, OIT wishes to continue to partner with institutions across the state to ensure there are sufficient workforce personnel to serve both the urban and rural needs. Our plan will double the number of bachelor's degree graduates in these programs by 2010. And Oregon's community colleges play an extremely important role as well in addressing this shortage. And we will continue to develop those partnerships with them to assure that high-quality education services are distributed both cost-effectively and regionally in both urban and rural areas. Another bill, Senate Bill 882, which we support, proposes a continuing statewide needs assessment to identify where and how programs should be offered. Another part of our plan is the transferability. We are committed to developing that seamless transition between allied health programs with the community colleges and other universities. We'll continue to develop collaborative efforts with Oregon Health Science University. We're obviously proud of our tradition of excellence and the success of our graduates and of the relationships we have with the medical industry to meet the needs of the workforce. I again want to thank Representative Garrard, Representative Gilman, and Senator Doug Whitsitt for sponsoring this bill, which will give OIT the additional credibility we need as we pursue our business plan. We have developed a network, And I thank you very much for this opportunity to put this bill before you. I thank you also and urge you to approve it. Thank you very much, Representative Dalton.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Boone.
I'm just curious why in the amendment Allied Health is, takes out diet, nutrition, and the rest of those.
I think the definition of allied health, Representative Boone, we have looked at, and there's several different definitions. For OIT, those programs are not currently part of our allied health portfolio, so that's why that happened.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Okay. Thanks very much.
Chair Dalto, thank you for the courtesy this morning.
Oh, thank you, Representative Gerard, for bringing this bill forward. Okay, Julie Sahonik. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, my name is Julie Sahonik. I'm the General Government Relations lobbyist for the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon and over 330,000 students. We're also the leading trainers of nurses in the state of Oregon. What I brought up alongside me, he's, I think, signed up right below me, is President Fred Smith of Klamath Community College. We just wanted to testify before you today and let you know that we do support House Bill 2754, that we believe that it is a key vehicle for us to continue the partnerships that we have with the university system, especially in this area of allied health, and that we really enjoy and continue to work with OIT in partnering with the community colleges statewide. They have done an excellent job of reaching out to us to provide distance education and other programs so that it's not just limited to the region in the southern part of the state. We also think that as we continue to face the short in nursing, that it's these types of innovative partnerships and ideas that will help us move us through this shortage and into the future and provide the needed workforce for allied health. So we urge you to support this bill. And then I'll have Fred Smith speak.
Great. For the record, Chair Dalto, I'm Fred Smith. I'm the president of Klamath Community College, and we support this bill without reservations. OIT is our partner, and we're separated by 5 miles, and we partner for about everything that we do together. And in fact, in the month of May, we will meet the president, Marthan, myself, the two superintendents, and our health professionals to actually start to scope out a K through 16 health program with different dropout points for individuals who want less than associate, and a baccalaureate degree. So anything that we can do to help OIT and help them with their allied health programs, we're committed to do. So
how seamless is your program with OIT, I suppose, going back and forth between 2-year and 4-year degrees?
We have very seamless things in some areas, and we have work yet in others. If you take our criminal justice, our education and early childhood ed programs, and then match them to applied psychology, I mean, it's a perfect match. In our business program, we're still working on the articulation there. Our engineering program, our pre-engineering, and their engineering program are getting closer and closer. Now that we have used some grant money to improve their laboratories so we can share our welding program and welding for their pre-engineers. So we work very, very close. We still have places we have to work better together, but on a whole, we're very good together.
That's great. Questions or comments? Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Joe Bell and Molly Moore.
Yeah, spreading out here. Totally under control.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I am Joe Bell with the Oregon Association of Hospitals, 59 hospitals across the state. And as part of my position with the Hospital Association, one of my primary focuses is the healthcare workforce development and retention issues. OIHHS would like to express our support of House Bill 2754. It reflects our ideas about how Oregon needs to address the healthcare workforce shortages, and we believe that we need to focus as a state on the needs of the students and what it is that will help them be successful in completing programs. To do this, some of the things that we need to address are statewide access, student transferability between programs, course articulation, and common student outcomes. And while doing this, we must also be wise about the use of our resources. As everyone knows, we have limited state resources to fund the public education system. And at the same time, we also are having additional problems funding health care at the same time that almost all of our health care facilities are very active with their local partners in funding health care workforce education. So it behooves us to look at this a lot on a statewide basis. There are a couple of initiatives in Oregon that I would like to mention that are actually sort of parallel to what OIT is proposing here for the bachelor degrees. In the 2003 session, actually this committee and then the legislature passed a bill, House Bill 2577, which directed the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council to look at distance learning around the state and to make some recommendations. And one of the recommendations that they made really was to look at a system that focuses on the student and develops a seamless and accessible system around the state. And they also identified that we need to aggregate the needs. The second initiative is the Governor's Health Workforce Initiative, and I'm not going to speak any more about that because Molly is here to talk about that. And then finally, President Marthan Dow mentioned Senate Bill 882, which we are working very hard on this session. And basically what it will do is it establishes for the first time a statewide needs assessment process, actually statewide and regional needs assessment process, to determine where we need healthcare workforce and what those positions are around the state. The second part of the bill would be to allow the State Board of Education and the State Board of Higher Education to look at those needs assessments, and also the individual community colleges and higher educational institutions to also look at those needs assessments in developing their programs and to work together to make sure that we are maximizing the availability and the access of programs around the state, at the same time conserving resources by joining together. So we think that House Bill 2754 fits very nicely with all of these goals and are very supportive of it. The final thing that I did want to mention is that from the perspective of Oregon's future economy and our needs to grow the economy in Oregon, we must have an adequate healthcare workforce, because healthcare services are one of the first things that people look for when they're looking to locate in a community. And in order to do that, we have to ensure that we have the people there who can provide the services when it's needed. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and also thank you for your support of this bill.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Dalton, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Molly Moore, and I am the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative Coordinator, and I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2754. As you've heard from President Dow, and as you already know, the state is facing a critical crisis with regards to healthcare workforce and many issues in overcoming this crisis. The Oregon Employment Department states that the healthcare occupations are the fastest category of growing workers in Oregon, and the health services industry is the largest employer of the state, so healthcare workforce is critical. In the last legislative session, through great work that you all did and with other key stakeholders, you identified this crisis, and the governor then asked his staff to develop an initiative to respond to this crisis, and the governor's healthcare workforce initiative was launched. The overall vision of the initiative is to dramatically increase the quantity and the quality of the healthcare workforce. This initiative fits with the governor's overall policy of investing in workforce and stimulating economic growth through that investment. The initiative has six key elements. I won't go through all of them with you, but House Bill 2754 directly addresses one of these six key elements, which is to seek policies that lead to increased access, transferability, common student learning outcomes through the education system. This bill represents the kind of collaborative model that the governor really likes to see happen in our communities and really provides for an efficient way to deliver education to our students. With our resource, we must take every possible opportunity to really collaborate with others and to leverage our resources so that we are providing the right education to our students. The governor's office feels that House Bill 2754 helps to reach our goal of these kind of collaborative efforts. OIT has been a leader for over 50 years and has recognized the growing workforce challenges and shortages and has taken actions to address it. While the pure workforce numbers in allied health professions don't equal those of the nursing shortages, we are seeing many areas of need for allied health professions. And OIT, through this bill, is really taking a leadership position for these issues. Overall, the bill helps us reach the goal of providing the right number of healthcare workforce at the right place with the right education at the right time. It also ensures that our workforce has the access to training opportunities and living wage jobs, particularly in rural communities where it's needed the most. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity and fully support House Bill 2754.
Great. Thanks. Molly, any questions?
Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question to Molly, and that is, Molly, your mention is that this will assist us in healthcare in rural Oregon, but it really helps healthcare statewide, and its target is statewide, but it will certainly help in rural areas because the folks in southern Oregon understand the rural perspective.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, I absolutely concur with you. I was really just pointing out that the rural communities are of the greatest needs in many regards, and that this is truly a statewide opportunity, and we fully support that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Thank you both. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify that didn't get a chance to sign up on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2754 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3268. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 3268 requires the Department of Human Services to provide notice to individuals before conducting an assessment for service eligibility. It is also granting those individuals the right to appeal any change to their service priority levels. We made some changes in the service priority levels in the special sessions and last session, and this bill is addressing a different process in assessing those level changes and the procedure around that.
Okay, thanks very much. Representative Buckley, are you available? Can somebody let Representative Escobar know that he... Okay, great. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and consideration. We were going to let Representative Escobar lead us off, but
you're it.
Dampen your time here a little bit. I'll go ahead and start. As soon as I start, he'll walk.
The watch pot never boils.
All right. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Buckley, State Representative, District 5. Very much appreciate the opportunity to offer testimony on House Bill 3268. I'd also like to express my gratitude to Representative Escobar, Senator Bates, and Senator Westland for their assistance and support. There are many people from around my district and around the state who could offer better testimony than I can as to the need for this bill. I believe some of them have called your offices, but given the difficulty of travel for many of them, Representative Escobar and I will have to speak on their behalf. This bill is simple. It might seem like a very small step, but it's a vital step in the direction of respect and dignity for seniors, the disabled, their families, their caregivers, and their caseworkers as well. It comes about from what all parties would agree was a horrible stretch of time in our state over the past several years, when budget cutbacks have required the Department of Human Services to drastically reduce or eliminate basic care for many seniors and disabled citizens in Oregon. The pressure on the department was and continues to be severe. The experience of our seniors and our disabled has been extremely painful. Thank you for joining the representative. Jumping on in. I've got us going here. Are you still looking for your notes on this here? I still got another copy of that. I think I have this one line for you. I'm going to, if it's okay, let Representative Escobar give his kind of intro to this.
Oh, by all means.
I'll jump back in.
Mr. Chair, fellow representatives, I'm Sal Escobar. I'm representative from District 6, which is Medford. This is a cooperative venture between the Senate and the House, and as well as a bipartisan approach to some, what we feel, some inequities in our system. In the 2002 special session, DHS was facing a budget crisis and had to limit the number of Oregonians it could serve. DHS cut coverage for seniors with disabilities identified as survival priority levels 12 through 17, as classified by the activities of a daily living system. Clients were reevaluated and reprioritized, leaving SPD levels 12 to 17 without services. Often seniors and people with disabilities, frequently suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia, would receive a call from their caseworker to notify them only days before a visit and a reevaluation, often resulting in the termination of their services. An agency review also found that many of these people, initially cut out of the system, are now back in the system at a higher level of impairment, ultimately resulting in a higher cost per case. This system is clearly not working for our seniors and our people with disabilities. We will outline today, Representative Buckley, I have another meeting that I'm involved in, so I zipped over here. We will give you a solution and a proposal that I think is amicable to all people, as well as beneficial to our seniors and our people with disabilities. So I urge for you to pass this bill out to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
What Representative Escobar was referring to with the cuts in funding, this has transformed the work of the senior and disabled caseworkers in the Department of Human Services. Not only do caseworkers have much greater numbers of clients to oversee, but their mandate has changed as well. Each year, caseworkers are required to evaluate seniors and disabled citizens receiving federal and state assistance. Until recent years, this has been a fairly routine task. The caseworker meets with the client, evaluates their situation using the activities of daily living, and works out the plan for care for the coming year. I've included the explanation of the activities of daily living scale in the packet I provided to you. With the major cuts in recent years, however, the pressure on caseworkers has been to identify seniors and disabled citizens who they can recommend to be removed from assistance. There's been no other choice. But the consequences of those decisions are significant. In a recent discussion with the Director of Senior and Disabled Services of Multnomah County, it was reported that when the county tracked just over 800 seniors and disabled citizens removed from services in 2003, over 130 of them, 17%, had died within 6 months. The Department of Human Services has done sample tracking as well, and their initial sampling has shown that a majority of seniors or disabled removed from services in recent years are now back in the system, receiving an even greater level of care due to the health consequences of being deprived of assistance. I could tell dozens of stories of the problems with the current process. In my town of Ashland, for instance, Rhea Jacoby, a victim of childhood polio, confined to a wheelchair and able to use only one of her arms, a woman who requires assistance to be moved from her wheelchair to use the toilet, came up for her annual evaluation in 2003. Up until this point, the yearly visit from a caseworker had always been what it had been originally been designed for, a review of Rhea's condition and the use of the ADL scale, the activities of daily living, to make sure she had the help she needed to have a dignified and decent life. In 2003, in a handful of days, she had been visited by a caseworker who she didn't really know, evaluated as being ineligible for assistance by having her ADL level drop from 9 to 13, and told that since the state could no longer offer to help people rated at level 13, all financial and personal assistance to her would be ended. Rhea and her husband, Nathan, were in shock. They knew nothing about the evaluation process, nothing about any possible way to appeal. They just knew that they were told the assistance was ending. Rhea informs me she seriously contemplated suicide. They had no idea of where to turn for help. Their plight found its way into the Ashland Daily Tidings, and Senator Len Hannon was notified. The senator visited Rhea and Nathan the next day, and he demanded that Rhea be reevaluated. She was, and her assistance was quickly restored. But not every story has this kind of happy ending. We've heard from numerous families whose older or disabled parent, sibling, or child has been removed from services without the family even being aware the evaluation was taking place, let alone that the services were in danger of being eliminated. The process, as DHS will tell you as well, must be improved. What we're asking with this bill is to simply mandate a communication process that will give families a better understanding of what the evaluation process is and what their rights are as citizens of the state. It requires a simple process of communication. It's a small first step. By mandating clear communication, information from family members, caregivers, and doctors will be available to caseworkers to allow for greatly improved evaluations. We're not here to blame anyone. We're here to look for solutions. I've included a sample letter in the packet, a draft of what DHS could send to clients that would explain the process and allow all involved to participate in a much more effective manner. It's a small step, but with your support, we'll take it. And we'll continue to seek ways to make sure the process by which we evaluate seniors and disabled citizens for assistance in Oregon is dignified, clear, and workable for all concerned. We've worked with DHS all the way through yesterday afternoon, and we're in agreement that we can make small adjustments to the bill as written to make it work better for the department. If directed to do so by the chair, we'll have those changes drafted immediately. If I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so, and again, I greatly appreciate this opportunity.
Why can't the Department of Human Services accomplish this through administrative rule?
Chair Dalto, an excellent question. My only response to that is that it has not been done. And I feel that with the weight of a statute, with the weight of the legislature behind it, we'll make sure this gets accomplished and carried out throughout the state.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, sir. I just want to make a couple of things clear. I really appreciate you here on this important issue. I spent a lot of my life working in long-term care, and I know that issue. You're not trying to change any of the criteria here, are you?
No. Chair Dalto, Representative Griffin, no, we're not. We're trying to change the process of communication with disabled and their families and seniors and their families.
And if I can follow, you're not trying to change the level at which services would be provided with this bill.
Right? Chair Dalto, Representative Greenock, I wish I could, but I'm not.
A separate process. Is it deemed as having any fiscal related to this?
Chair Dalto, Representative, we worked very hard with DHS to make sure there would not be a fiscal impact on this. With the suggestion of having a written notification and the time prior to the evaluation for the senior or disabled citizen and their family to be communicated with, we were willing to talk about phone call communication. The written communication we felt could be done without a fiscal as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to clarify that point. So right now, I think what I heard you testify to was that the Department of Human Services was giving individuals very short notice, just a couple of days in some circumstances before they either deleted them from service or reclassified them from service. And so under your proposal, the department would have, is it a 30-day window?
Chair Dalto, under our proposal, they would have to communicate a minimum of 14 days prior to the evaluation process. We would still keep the notification process in terms of if a service is going to be terminated, would still be, as practiced, 30 days. There is a provision currently, an emergency provision of 10 days. The department's going to work to make that 10 business days if there is an emergency funding, which would give it a little bit more time. Also, the bill includes a provision for an expedited hearing in case a elimination of services happens during the emergency situation so that the appeal process could happen while the senior or disabled citizen is still covered under services.
Well, I guess my point is if you were now requiring a minimum of 14 days, wouldn't that have the practical effect of keeping people in a level of service an additional set of days that they might not otherwise, based on the way it's being done right now, and thus, I think, costing the system more money?
Chair Dalto, the 14-day requirement is the requirement of notification of the evaluation itself, okay, Not the results of the evaluation. So it's the initial communication.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank
you
very much.
That.
Additional comments or questions?
Representative Butler. I'm perplexed. Would this preclude a surprise evaluation then? If they came in with the proper credential and said, I'm here from the DHS and I'm here to evaluate you, these folks are answering the door and otherwise would be in a walker somewhere, and they find that they're not in the walker, that would preclude that from happening then.
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler. It would not preclude a caseworker from visiting a client at any time. A caseworker could check on a client at any time. The annual evaluation process, though, which is required by the federal government because of the match, would be the process that would be require the notification of the client that the evaluation was going to take place. But the caseworker would still have access to the client at any time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mary Lee Fay. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. And I am here in support of House Bill 3268 as it's amended. As you've heard from Representative Buckley, the ability to make sure that clients who receive supports from our programs are as prepared as they can be in terms in times of reassessment is absolutely critical. What Representative Buckley bill proposes to do is to direct us to send notification prior to an annual assessment so that the person can be best prepared in understanding what happens during an assessment, that they can set up the meeting to be convenient to their time, and most importantly, that they can invite family members, friends, or others who know them well to participate in that evaluation. Oftentimes, people need that additional natural network to kind of help support and articulate their care needs. What this bill would direct us to do is to make sure everyone was reminded at any time we were doing these annual reassessments how they can think about it and how to communicate with their case manager when that case manager called. So in that regards, we are very supportive of this bill and believe that it indeed will assist us in making sure both the case manager is reminded on what their roles and duties are and that the people who receive our supports are also aware of what happens during an assessment and how to prepare for it. Other items in the bill does identify the ability to clarify if there was an emergency and reductions were made to an entire program that we would have 10 business days at a minimum to do notification. Currently, we have a 30-day requirement as long as we have 60 days of notification prior to either a federal change or a legislative direction to change. So it does give a little more time for the case manager and the client themselves to be informed in how to look at what their rights are as well as what the impact of a service reduction might be. So for that, we are in support of House Bill 3268.
Representative Cameron.
Mary, thanks for being here. I guess follow-up to the chair's question, why aren't we doing this without this legislation?
Representative Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, I believe that when we do training and in our administrative rules, case managers are indeed trying to notify. I think one of the problems that we've heard about is that individuals aren't reminded and prepared to invite their families and friends. One of the things our system does not do is keep a database on the relatives or the individuals who are close to them, so our communication ends up being often phone calls between the case manager and the client. Sometimes the written notification is something that family member may see and know is coming and want to make sure they're invited. One of the things that does happen is during a visit, people tend to want to put on their absolute best face. They want to present themselves as capable as they can and may not be able to communicate some of the changes that they've experienced. And family members being present often can help kind of fill that picture in. So what this would do is really make sure that there was a written communication going with enough leeway time that a family member or a friend might know that it's time for that reassessment, make sure I'm invited, at that type of information. So it just strengthens, I believe, the type of communication that's now going on.
Well, I guess I still don't understand why I mean, if it's a good policy and DHS supports it, why don't we just do it?
Representative,
I mean, why don't we send a letter today to the relatives?
Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, I believe we think it's a good idea. I believe we would probably act on this with or without the bill. I think that the one support that a bill sometimes has is what this requires is a change in the information systems, and we would have to make some changes to our computer systems to make sure this gets out. It puts it on a higher priority. But I agree that it's a good idea. As we've been meeting with Representative Buckley, we have certainly understood the issues that he's been presenting and wholeheartedly support the idea with or without the bill.
Thank you. President Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Lee, this has nothing to do with this bill, but you mentioned the federal match, and tell us what the federal match is for these.
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, this program is a Medicaid-funded program. It's a part of a home and community-based waiver, which means that the individuals in this program are first eligible for a nursing home, but rather than going to a nursing home, we're able to use federal dollars as well as state dollars to support them. The current match rate is an estimate of 60% federal dollars and 40% state dollars. With that, of course, comes a set of program requirements on directing us to make sure that we meet both the needs of the individuals, the health, the safety, and put an entire plan together that's directed at the care, and that we're doing this in lieu of nursing home program.
Which are a lot more expensive. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mary Lee.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Greenlake and then Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This home and community-based waiver program is based on the assumption that these people will be in nursing homes. Did that evaluation that I heard a good representative talk about before indicate that when you knock them out of services for home and community-based services, many of them did end up in nursing homes in a more expensive way?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, actually the assessment is the same for nursing home and community-based care. And the assessment, it starts with the premise that the person is first eligible for a nursing home. And if they are eligible for a nursing home, they can choose to stay in their community at less costly services and one that meets their needs. If they were not eligible for the community program, they would not have been eligible for a nursing home. So they would not have, if they lost their service because we did adjust the program, and if they were no longer eligible for the community program, they also were not eligible for nursing home access. So when you heard Representative Buckley talk about individuals who, after we had terminated those services, without the support, there was indeed a decline in health and care need, they came back into our system at a greater disability level, and then were eligible for services yet again.
Any follow-up, sir?
Follow-up.
Yeah, that's what used to be called the 360 evaluation or something. Is that? That's changed,
yes.
Now. But there is some severe limit. Haven't we imposed an external limitation on the number of people who can be served on this?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlake, in the current governor's budget, there is, as we've looked at the budget situation, there is a proposal to look at a waiver cap. The federal government does allow each state to cap services of people who might have access to the community-based services. However, you can't apply that cap to nursing homes. So it would only be a limited number of individuals in access to in-home foster care, assisted living facilities, or residential care facilities.
Let me follow.
Well,
so as I understand that budget cap, the notion would be to take people, to cap the number of people that can be in less expensive services and require them to be moved into more expensive services?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, I think most states, when they have used it, have looked at the idea that if people were waiting 30, 60, 90 days, they might wait that amount of time rather than go into a nursing home, but it's certainly a risk, and it's one that I know we're prepared to talk about during our Phase 2 presentation in the budget committees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just noted down this bill mandates better scheduling and calendaring practices for DHS. And number two, affords the clients written information about appeals. Does the second issue relative to the appeals, does it actually afford them better written information about their appeals, or does it give them additional and grant them additional appeal rights?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, we currently do give the individuals written information about their appeal rights at the time of the hearing. I believe what this does is give additional written information at the time of the assessment, even prior to any termination. So it is not additional appeal rights. It is just more clarification of when they could appeal and why.
So my second point, Mr. Chair, affords the client written information about the appeals. Again, I'm concerned that those are all issues that you folks should have been doing to start off with. You have to have legislation to tell you to do the things, to do better scheduling and calendaring practices within the agency, and to afford the clients better written information about their appeals.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, we give both verbal and written information about appeal rights at a time when there is a proposed change in service benefit level or termination. What this would do is have us indicate in an overall letter that should that be the case, they know up front what that is.
That isn't available at present.
We have not done that to date in that kind of a written notification.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Okay. Thanks, Mary Lee. Thank you. Jacqueline Zimmer. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, also known as O4AD. And we're here in support of this bill. We helped Representative Buckley and his staff work on this bill. We appreciate it. I'm here just to do a little cleanup this morning of some of the questions and comments that have come before you today. One of them is to let you know that this bill sort of blossomed as a result of the cuts that the legislature proposed to level service priority levels 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 last biennium. So actually before all of the cuts to those levels were proposed, we didn't really have significant issues in the areas of notification and appeal because we weren't a system that was designed to throw people off. We actually, when we did evaluations for people, and our case managers do have contact with them prior to arrival for their hearing and review every year, but we do contact them. But most clients that we would visit, we weren't going there to actually move them off of the system. We were actually doing a health and well-being check. And quite honestly, if we had the resources, we would check in with our clients more frequently during the year to make sure that they were doing well. So this whole bill is kind of a result of the legislature's underfunding in these particular programs. So just to let you know that we haven't been living with long-term problems with this. And so people's pleas to this particular issue are being responded to this session. The legislature during the last session when all the cuts were coming up, on a number of occasions we were asked to not notify our clients about proposed changes and to not alarm them and to not get them fired up and scared and alerted, because legislators were in fact getting a lot of calls and acting as case managers during that time period, and you yourselves didn't really know where to refer people, and in fact you were referring them back to our offices, and it was just a circle, and it really didn't go anywhere because we couldn't tell people for sure whether or not they were going to lose services. We couldn't tell them what we could refer them to as an alternative, and so short notice kind of became the law of the land during all of those special sessions, and we were actually told to not warn people in a lot of cases. So this piece of legislation will, I want you to remind you of that when if there are any more cuts that come down the way. The other thing I wanted to mention to you was that we don't do surprise evaluations in our offices. We don't have the time to surprise our clients. We actually try to get them on the phone and we do in our files do have sometimes their care providers or family members that we can contact to let them know. So it isn't just us marching into their home and surprising somebody. A lot of times when we can, we do notify other people that there will be an evaluation going on, because, as Mary Lee said, we do know good days from bad days and good hours from bad hours. And it does sometimes take other family members to help fill in the blanks and help someone remember that they're maybe not doing as well as they might think they are. And this is a proud people that we're working with. And even today when we interview clients in the relative foster care program who are going to more than likely end up in a nursing home, they say, well, I'll be fine. And they most certainly are not going to be fine. That's why they're in our system. So it's sort of a source of pride that has people tell you that they'll be fine. And they don't want to go in a nursing home, so they'll also sometimes tell us that they're fine. So at any rate, we support this. We appreciate it. Again, we're not a system designed to move people off. And I think that at the time that all of these issues were coming together, the department was amending the language in the service priority levels to clear up areas that were vague and to allow for clarification. So when we went in and did evaluations, some people just didn't fit the criteria as they had before, simply because the language had really been strengthened and cleaned up. So I offer that not as an excuse, but just as background as to why you're sitting here today looking at this particular bill. And we support this, but we'd also support never having to send out another letter telling someone they're being moved off of services. So, and the cap that you're talking about that's proposed would keep us from allowing new people to come into our system at a time when the demographics tell us that the fastest growing population is 85 and older, and also that the people with disability population is growing as well. So that cap is very nerve-wracking to us and will produce more calls to you from people who know that they can't get services unless they go to a nursing home.
Mr. Chair, if I can comment on that. That cap is something that's going to be taken up, I think, in ways and means, but I think it has some pretty important substantive issues around it, and it might be very useful if we could also hear the bill that's proposed. It isn't exactly a bill. It's proposed in the governor's budget and hasn't been added back in the co-chairs, but I think the impact on the long-term care system is something we might want to take up as a substantive issue as well as a fiscal issue.
Mr. Chair, if I could, that will be in the Human Services budget bill, and I believe that the Senate in their co-chair budget added the funding back in to relieve us of the cap. The House has not yet done that, and I think it was about a little over $7 million budget item, and in addition to the cap, we also will lose somewhere around $14 to $15 million in federal funds without that cap. So what it does in fact is tell us to tell people that they can sit and wait for help or go to the nursing home. We'd like to see that added back in on both sides.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3268 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3443. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3443 is creating a 211 statewide telephone number, which the number will provide access to Health and Human Services and available services for after an emergency. It directs the Office of Emergency Management to establish the program. In its current form, the bill appropriates money. I believe attached to your SMS, you have an amendment that they will be speaking to today that hopefully removes the fiscal impact. Otherwise, this bill, as in its current form, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. This is an exciting time for Oregon to be on the leading edge of helping people in crisis. Currently, Multnomah County, along with Washington and Clackamas County, have instituted a 211 non-emergency help number. This will, one, save the state and a lot of local emergency centers some money in the future when people in a crisis that isn't really a law enforcement or a medical emergency will be able to call a resource line and get help for their spouse, for their grandparent, or just whatever needs that they have that they don't know where to turn to, but they do have a personal crisis that isn't a medical or a police emergency or a fire emergency. It's working well in Multnomah County to date. I've had friends call it and have gotten great service and been able to get assistance. There will be federal money available to help the state Office of Emergency Management to work on these contracts, and this is just the beginning of developing a statewide system. And I will leave all the details to some other folks that are here to talk about this bill, but I think it's a great start, and you have the Dash 1 amendments that we worked on with some folks that have special districts, and also to make sure that this bill doesn't create some huge cost to the state.
You know, my first question, Representative Marks, or the first thing that comes to mind when I looked at this last week was, why limit it to human service type issues? Why not expand it to sort of all areas of state government that people might need assistance in?
Well, the primary point where someone has a personal crisis has involved human services. It's usually, how do I get help for my grandmother who's living alone at home and's not eating her meals, and you know, how can I get someone in to assist her? Things like I need to get a business license don't sort of rise to that level of an emergency. And as Oregon's going to a more e-government system, those kinds of inquiries will be able to be handled through internet access and that point. Also, I mean, this has been the traditional rollout nationally. Eventually, we will have a national system for 211 that will be generally, you know, state specific, like we're doing here. But and it's been around the human services issue.
Okay, Representative Greenlee.
Good morning, Representative March. Thanks for testifying. This important issue. I have a single question. I'm trying to find out how the impact of the amendments takes away the fiscal. And in the original form, it says the Office of Emergency Management shall do this and shall do that. And in the amended version, it says they should let a contract to have that done. Why is letting a contract take away the fiscal?
There will still be some money involved, but what we're doing is taking away the general fund. I believe, as I understand it, that or the general fund will be de minimis. We haven't totally eliminated any expenditure because, like I mentioned, we're going to have some federal grants available. It's going to also be contracted out rather than done within the way the original bill was written. It looked like it's being done totally within the office, and so we're trying to clean that up. I'm not positive we've got 100 there that we've avoided a fiscal impact 100%. We haven't gotten a fiscal on it yet.
If I can follow that. So it's Section 9 that creates a separate account and says the money's not a part of the general fund that does that?
Right.
Is your assumption then that the money will come from federal and other?
And other grants, yes.
And other places. And they're going through that account, and that account's what will be used to?
Correct.
To manage the contract. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, March, could you elucidate a little bit how much of this will be recorded material, how much will be actual online nurses or operators or people to refer?
Well, as it's currently working in Multnomah County, you get a live person. So it's like talking to an emergency operator, and they have at their fingertips a large database that has been developed over a number of years from a number of sources in Multnomah County, for example. The aging services folks had their database. The people that worked with people on applying for temporary assistance had their database. People working with children had their database, and we've taken all of those databases, merged them into one, and then worked with the adjoining counties as well of Washington and Clackamas to merge that into sort of like one super database. So if you're calling and you're in East County, they will refer you. One, they'll find out what is the proper agency to deal with your particular emergency, and then they'll refer you to the closest one to you. So it might be a non-profit provider out in Gresham, for example, that will handle your issue.
Follow up. There will be any health information for access, or is it just for referral? In other words, if you want to access information on diabetes for a family member that may be having some minor problems,
you know,
that type of information be included?
To that extent, to the depth of specific medical advice, I don't believe they will be giving medical advice, but they would refer you to the correct agency that would be able to connect you.
Okay. Follow up. My last, I would just want to seek assurance that we won't be contracting out and hearing a voice from New Delhi.
It's not happening now. So I would hope I'm not.
New Delhi.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Reverend Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great job. Next, I'd like to invite Ellen Lowe, George Grosh, and Lizelle Wendt forward, please.
Kinds of in the night hours as their x-rays were at the angle in the radio. We're visualizing their reader because it's a daytime at the angle.
Good evening, Jay.
Vice Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as Public Policy Counsel for United Way of the Columbia Willamette. And it's on their behalf that I seek your endorsement of 3443 with the amendment. I can respond to a couple of the questions. One, Chair Dalto asked why it wasn't broader than health and human services. And this number was established by the Federal Communications Commission now almost 5 years ago, specifically for public access to information about and referral to health and human services. And in most instances, human services really is community service. And so in a lot of instances, it has a broader application than some of us think of. It's more than DHS, for example. It is the broader community. I would just like to give the bulk of the time to the people who have been working in establishing this. But I would say that when the federal government established this number, they really left it up to the states. And in this state, we had a group of folks who were extremely interested in implementing this. And they've gone about it in a very careful way, involving all the stakeholders, including the telecommunication folks, the helping agencies, government, not-for-profit, in particularly in the Tri-County area local governments as well. Those of you who are familiar with the history of United Way nationally and in Oregon know that information and referral has been part of their work forever. And in Oregon, that goes back 85 years. Because if you seek dollars, contributions from folks to fund services, and then you look at it and you see them being somewhat disconnected from the folks you want to serve, and you also don't want to set up an outreach and information and referral in each of those different components, you try to bring things together. And actually, I would say that to honor their what has been a commitment through their entire 85 years in the Portland area, United Way has contributed over $700,000 in the last 3 years to make sure that we're going to establish something that works and also provides a blueprint so that it can be expanded statewide. They've also gained over $300,000 in grants to assist this. And so usually I'm in hearing room F asking that things like this start, that we look for funding pilot projects for doing the research. You're going to hear from the folks today who have been part of this very careful strategy of designing a program that is ready to operate. And so when you look at the bill, and it in the original bill, lines 13 through 15, they say an integrated statewide system of local information and referral service providers will build upon an already existing network of experienced service providers without the necessity of creating a new agency or department. And then you look at the amendments, and you see up in lines 4 and 5 on page 1 that 211 system facilitator means an Oregon nonprofit organization that is devoted to creating a statewide 211 system.
Ellen, could you give me that reference again? I couldn't find it quickly enough. On the dash 1 amendment.
Okay, it would be on page 1 of the amendment, and it's line 4 and 5.
Thank you.
And that is, so when we talk about the facilitator, this is it. But it's also with all their stakeholders as well. And so I would... I am confident that when you hear from them, you'll see that this really is community building community. And I've suggested that it might even serve you, because from time to time, sometimes legislators even resort to calling me to help them find answers. And now you're going to be able to call 211. And I'll relinquish my spot to Jerry Shoemate, who will also talk about what's going on in Oregon. And then at the conclusion, I'd be happy to respond to any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Vice Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is George Grosch. I live at 720 Southeast Atwood Avenue in Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm here today as a representative of Oregon 211 and in support of House Bill 3443 as amended. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill, and I'd like to use the opportunity to let you know how we've come to this place today, the benefits of a fully functional 211 system, and how this bill moves us closer to the date when every person in the state of Oregon with a telephone can call 211 and have their questions answered and hopefully be on the road to getting their needs met. In Oregon, leadership for the development of 211 has been assumed by the Oregon 211 Coalition, a broad-based statewide collaboration of providers of information and referral services, agencies of state government, community action programs, and United Ways. Working together since 2000, we are committed to be prepared to bring this new resource to the state as quickly as possible. The goal of 211, of Oregon 211, is to build an integrated, efficient statewide system of call centers that will work together to provide telephone access to a trained information and referral specialist 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, providing the right information in the right way at the right time. The Oregon 211 Coalition began through a series of meetings of interested parties in late 2000 and was formalized in early 2001. From the outset, our goal has been to create a coordinated statewide effort to use the 211 dialing code as a tool to expand access to services for Oregonians. Throughout 2001 and 2002, working in cooperation with the Community Action Directors of Oregon and the Northwest Alliance of Information Referral Systems, we held a series of informational and coalition building sessions across the state. This phase of our work culminated in the creation of a formal steering committee in July of 2002, made up of providers, United Way of Oregon and local United Ways, Community Action Directors of Oregon, and key state governmental agencies. In April 2003, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation awarded a $250,000 grant for the development of 211 across the Pacific Northwest. Portions of this funding enabled Oregon 211 to complete a formal strategic business planning process. The process included ongoing consultation with local and statewide providers of both information and referral services and direct health and human services, United Ways, local and county governments, and state government agencies to ensure that the emerging system will be responsive to their needs and built in partnership with them. In May 2003, we organized the first state 211 summit to launch our formal strategic business planning process, and now complete the plan that we have is ready to be implemented. Today, we've moved from a grassroots coalition to an incorporated entity, Oregon 211. With many of the same partners serving on our boards of directors, we're now implementing 211 service across the state. Our goal is to have the system fully operational within 2 to 3 years. As you'll hear in a moment, we currently have one call center operational in the metro area, and there are planning activities, developing business plans in Lane County and in Douglas and Jackson counties that will eventually serve a 7-county area in southern Oregon. House Bill 3443 is amended is important because it positions Oregon for the receipt of federal funds currently under consideration in Congress. Senate Bill 211 establishes a mechanism for national implementation of a comprehensive 211 system and allocates $150 million for support of that system. There's companion legislation in the House of Representatives, House Bill 896, that does the same. With support from United Way of America and the Alliance of Information and Referral Systems, this legislation establishes the mechanism to complete the work that we've begun. In the last session of Congress, 5 states received earmarked funds for 211 support, and we're optimistic that this legislation will pass, and House Bill and local and Oregon House Bill 3443 creates the mechanism to receive those funds and designates how those funds will be appropriated. House Bill 3443 is amended, is in alignment with the wording of the federal legislation. So when fully realized, the Oregon 211 system, the 211 system will become a ubiquitous social utility of increasing importance to the state, and it will help to create new efficiencies to meet people's needs, provide a new way in which local and state government can respond to the expectations and the needs of all citizens, employ a high-touch personal interaction to analyze callers' needs and impact their lives, provide an expanded infrastructure to connect individuals with precise information and social services that address their needs, generate new and useful data that can be aggregated and analyzed at the state and local levels for improvements in legislation affecting social services, and enable people throughout the state to give help as well as to get help. House Bill 3443 is amended as the next step in this process to realize the vision of 211 for Oregonians. Thank you, and when we're done, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks very much.
Chairman Dalto, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Wendt, and I'm here today representing 211 Info, the local call center in the Portland metro area. First, I have to tell you, when I started working on this project at United Way, my son, who's 10 and a little bit down the Coy side, said, "Why does it take so long for you to get 3 digits to ring?" Because he was thinking our 10-digit home number rings just fine, and 3 should be easier than 10. Well, it is a difficult concept, and we've made a lot of progress. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happened on a national level, so you'll have a bit of context for this particular bill.
As you're now aware, the FCC set aside the three-digit number in July of 2000 for the purpose of Health and Human Services. Per the question earlier around government services, there is another N11 number, 311, which the FCC set aside for non-emergency government services. So cities like Chicago and New York are using that for government information and launching work order processes, et cetera.
I thought it was a 211. It's a 311.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That clears it up for me. Thanks.
People dial 211 and they receive information about help such as rent assistance, health care, utility assistance. Those are the number three issues that people right now are calling in the metro area. And again, Jerry will talk a little bit more about that later. 211 can also play a significant role in a disaster situation, as indicated most recently by Florida 211s in the hurricanes of 2004. Call volume at those local 211s increased 25 to over 300%. It's certainly testing the limits of that system and giving us a lot to learn from. 211 has often been called elegant in its simplicity. You've got a map on the testimony that I submitted that's a little on the blurry side, but those little dots are where there are existing 211 call centers across the country. Right now, 211 reaches approximately 108 million Americans, which is over 37% of the U.S. population. When the FCC set aside the number, the challenge that they gave the United Way of America and information referral providers across the country is that they wanted to see 50% access to all Americans by July of 2005, so the clock is a bit ticking on that. One of the reasons for that was there are only so many N11 numbers, and they wanted to make sure that those numbers were used in the best way possible. The different 211 centers across the country range from a statewide 211 in Connecticut, which is funded with primarily state dollars. Over 85% of their budget is from state dollars, to Metropolitan Atlanta, which was actually the first 211, and that's funded primarily by United Way of Atlanta dollars. On a federal level, there are two noteworthy policy efforts. George talked about one of them, Senate Bill 211, which we're amused that number got assigned, but happy about that. And that would earmark $150 million with a 50% match requirement to states. And that would be for startup and operations of 211 centers. The other piece is the Public Health, Security, and Bioterrorism Preparedness and Response Act of 2002, which authorized state block grants and established 211 as an allowable use of funds. So on a national level, there certainly is a recognition of the role that 211 has played post 9/11 in Connecticut, and certainly the potential that it has to reach a broad audience. Should the federal legislation, Senate Bill 211, pass, each state needs a designated 211 entity to implement 211 in that state. The federal legislation mandates building on existing INR systems when they are in place. And that was written specifically to avoid setting up a new state agency or program, but really building on the existing community action programs and United Way funded INRs. That said, 211s have demonstrated their nimbleness and utility in several crisis situations. From post 9/11 in Connecticut, where the governor instituted 1-800 Connecticut Helps, but overwhelmingly people called 211. It was already operational in Connecticut, and they field calls everything from, I can't find someone, I want to volunteer, my water's shut off, what can I do? To Atlanta 211, which at the same time, people were stranded at the Atlanta airport post 9/11. All the hotels were booked, and that 211 ended up playing a spontaneous booking service for residents in the Atlanta area who were willing to open their homes to people who were stranded. And it was 211 that was on the news stations doing the connection because they were known in the community and had a database that could handle that spontaneous need. And again, certainly Florida 211 played a significant role in the most recent hurricanes. 211 was the elegant solution in Florida, and it certainly can be Oregon's response to basic needs and potential disaster. House Bill 3443, with the amendments, ensures a local and effective communication system is available for all Oregonians. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions? Comments? No. Okay. Thanks very much.
Chair Dalfo, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jerry Shoemate, and I serve as the executive director of 211 Info, the information referral center currently providing 211 service in the Portland metropolitan area. And I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3443 as amended. Last month, Andrea called us. Andrea is a young single mother with three small children, and she asked whether we knew of anyone who could help her pay her electric bill. She just received a three-day shut-off notice and didn't know where to turn. The 211 staff member who had answered the call listened for a few moments and then asked her a few questions to better understand her situation. He then told her about three places that she might call to get the help that she was seeking. We called her back last week to
to see if she was in fact able to get the help that she needed. And this young mother said that St. Vincent de Paul had been able to help her, that she and her children had her electric bill paid, and they now have a plan for staying current with their heating bills. Andrea represents more than 100,000 people that we spoke with during 2004 at 211 Info. Now, we do not have the capacity to call back even a tiny fraction of that 100,000 people, but we know that we made a difference for Andrea, and we know that we do make a difference every day for hundreds of people calling us. 211 service is definitely much more than a telephone assistance line. We seek to build a relationship with every caller so that we can provide the most appropriate referrals for each caller's situation. We bring interpreters online whenever needed for our non-English speaking callers. 211 service is based on nationally established standards. Staff receive ongoing training. They complete an examination and review process to become certified information and referral specialists. The Oregon 211 system is based on these same national standards to assure that a quality service is provided for all Oregonians. Oregon 211 is working, as you've heard, with telecommunication and social service providers across the state so that the Andreas of all the communities in the state can speak with a professional, compassionate human being to find answers to their basic needs. One comment I wanted to make, in the Portland area, the 50% match that the federal legislation will require is in fact already in place. We are funded through the United Way, very generously through United Way. Cities are partnering with us, the counties are. We do some innovative sales of print directories and essentially have that 50% match already made.
Excuse me. Representative Freeman.
Is that for the metro area, or are you talking about statewide? You have a
50%? In our community, we serve the four counties, and that 50% match is made. I know that the other communities across the state are likewise raising those match dollars, again, from United Ways, from partnering with cities, other specialized lines, for example.
If I may follow. So you expect in that Section 9 of the amendments that fund will be filled sufficiently with non-governmental funds in order to match the federal contribution?
That would be true at this point, yes.
Thank you.
I'd like to close with one more story that demonstrates the collaborative nature of our system. Bill called us one day a few months back. He was clearly upset and had difficulty expressing his needs. The information and referral specialist determined immediately that Bill was not in any danger and then spent time asking questions to get a clearer picture of his concerns. Eventually, the specialist determined that Bill was tired of his life of abusing alcohol and drugs, but he needed help to make the enormous changes that he knew were in front of him. The specialist told Bill about the Oregon Partnership, the well-established statewide helpline for people in Bill's situation. They spoke together about the services that the Oregon Partnership could offer, and eventually the specialist asked Bill if he could call Oregon Partnership while Bill remained on the phone. Bill agreed, and the three of them then spoke for a couple of minutes, with the specialist eventually handing the call off to the professional at Oregon Partnership after helping to clarify Bill's needs to that other specialist. The call transferred to Oregon Partnership because they have the deeper level of awareness about what could help Bill in his specific situation. 211 staff are trained to provide information on a broad spectrum, but when there's a specialized line, it's imperative that we partner with them so that the client can get that deeper level of service. Thank you for considering House Bill 3443 as amended, and I would urge your support, and I will also be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks very much, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. Your last illustration with Bill kind of triggered a thought. Because this is a state agency, would there be any ability for you to tie in or patch into any of the faith-based services for a synagogue or church or mosque to provide those services?
Absolutely. We work as an independent nonprofit organization. We partner with anyone who's providing a social service. We do have an inclusion-exclusion criteria that helps us make sure we're partnering with reputable organizations, but we have a number of faith-based organizations. They provide such an enormous amount of help in the community that we need them as well.
Great.
Sure.
I'm sorry I missed some of the testimony, but I was wondering in an early section, maybe one of the three of you could respond. I really appreciate the fact that the federal government is putting quite a number of funds into this service, and at this point, all of the funds, if I understand. Are there any of the states that do have this service that are relying on a service charge added to the phone charges?
That has been that has not been a strategy that's been approached at this point. There was an early awareness that we did not wish to compromise the stability of the 911 system, mm-hmm. and we need to be good partners with them. And so that was kind of an early agreement that we would not be looking for funding in that way. At this point, then, I don't think that has happened. I know the discussion continues, but I don't think it's set up anywhere like that.
In many states, you know, federal excise or telephone excise taxes are used for 911 services, and Oregon does that as well. 911 service providers are very sensitive to that, and that was part of the feedback that we got in the early development of this. If you want to fund this and you want to partner with these organizations, you know, it's best that this is that you folks know that this is an important thing to us. We've been able to put what we have together by blending funds that are available and some new funds.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Have you been able to quantify how many calls that you take off the 911 system?
We have not done an analysis of that kind. I think that work may be happening in other communities. One of the things that I've learned is that, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, the 911 system has done quite an excellent job of educating the public to know what is an appropriate call to 911, and I don't think that the volume of inappropriate calls is what it used to be for 911 centers. I think that there will be very obvious opportunities to co-market, co-partner, to help the community know for sure when you're calling 911, when you should call 211. That's been very effective in other communities like Atlanta.
And the follow-up. When you get a call that's clearly a 911 call, how do you patch it through, or do you just recommend that they call 911?
We can go a couple of different directions. And what our first priority is to have them actually dial 911. If we patch the call through, the 911 operator does not have the locator information. We actually had a caller, however, who was blind, diabetic, and had his phone programmed for 211 and got through to us. And in that unique situation, he was moving into a diabetic coma and was not expressing his needs very well. And we were able to get the 911 dispatcher on the phone, have a three-way call, got enough information out of him so that she could send an officer driving around his neighborhood. He opened the door so that the officer could find the open door, and you know, it was all solved. I would like to not do very many like that. It wasn't the best way to help the caller, but he did get help, and that was the bottom line.
Great. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How successful have you been in avoiding busy signals or long waits on the phone? And when they call you, do they have to dial 1 if they want you to answer a left-handed question and 3 a right-handed question? And my pet peeve.
Mine too. The standards suggest that there is a maximum amount of wait time that a caller should have to wait. What we have established in the metro area is that our maximum wait time is 45 seconds. Currently, that's at about 31 seconds. What a caller hears when they first dial it is, you have reached 211 info, the community's information referral line, a specialist will be with you shortly. And then it immediately rings to a person's desk, so the caller does not need to work their way through any menu.
There's an interesting piece to your question, the Representative Greenlee. You know, because the way phone systems work, 211 only requires, if you remember rotary phones, when you would dial a rotary phone and you'd hear click, 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 for the numbers going through, there's a thing called phantom call. And because there are only 4 clicks to 211, oftentimes electrical activity in the world will cause phantom calls to happen. So the phone will ring at the 211 call center, but there'll be nobody on the end of the phone because it's a phantom call. And so the way that
you deal with that is doing what Mary's done.
Or because I did it by mistake.
Yeah. What many call centers do is they put in an automatic voice response, an automatic, before you press a button, because that makes a difference. You know, the phantom call isn't going to press a button. And so if you press a button, that gets you immediately to a call specialist. But there are some unique things about the way phone systems operate that I never thought I would learn, but that was one of them.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. And I have Mike Feldman. Is Mike Feldman here? Great.
No, I think it's our primary number, not the actual one.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chairman Dalto and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. My name is Michael Feldman. I'm the executive director of the Umpqua Community Action Network, also known as UCAN. And UCAN is the community action agency for Douglas County. And our main offices are located in Roseburg, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3443 as amended. And to help you understand a little why I'm supporting this legislation, I'd like to tell you about two incidents that happened in the community of Winston, just south of Roseburg. About 7 years ago, that community had the unfortunate event of having two teen deaths, one being a suicide, occurring within a couple of months of each other. The local police chief, Bruce Justice, and a local pastor, Steve Shenowick, separately received many calls from parents and other teens and community members needing assistance with a large variety of issues surrounding these deaths. They spent a lot of time trying to connect people with the necessary resources and support that was needed, and often had to go through many wrong referrals before they found the right one, if they ever found the right one at all. After the immediacy of the situation subsided, these two community leaders were sharing their similar experiences and frustrations with meeting these requests for help, and decided our community needed one phone number that people and professionals could call to get accurate referral information when it was needed. From that discussion, Douglas County started what we call the Warm Line, which is a type of 211 service, and UCAN became the home for that service. Since its founding, the community has placed a high value on the need for this service. Over a year's period, we handle about 1,700 calls, and that is just really with minimal outreach efforts on our part. In neighboring county, Jackson County, a similar program called Community Works handles over 17,000 calls a year. And despite the obvious need, though, funding streams for this type of service are very scarce, and in Douglas County, we have struggled to keep our warm line afloat. Currently, we only have one half-time employee to staff the service, and even at that level, it's hard to keep it funded, and it does not meet the need. House Bill 3443 then really lays the groundwork for the possibility of maintaining and expanding this greatly needed service, especially if federal legislation is passed for this purpose to help fund it. Because of this possibility, UCAN has been an active partner with the development of the statewide 211 system from the beginning of these efforts here in Oregon. Recently, we have been meeting with representatives from the organization Community Works in Jackson County to lay the groundwork for creating a multi-county 211 call center in Southern Oregon that would provide 24-hour, 365-day-a-year service. By combining our efforts in Southern Oregon with this statewide OR211 effort and with 211 info, we have made great strides towards making 211 a possibility in Southern Oregon. This Southern Oregon system would have county-based call centers with local staff who are very familiar with the services in their community. These staff would take calls during the heavy use times and then share the call answering duties with the Jackson County program and OR211 and 211 info for the less busy times, or on the other side of the coin, for the really peak times when all the local staff are busy. By working with OR211, we are migrating our data systems to match what is already in use elsewhere in the state so that we can share these duties and share our referral database information. In doing this, we created the ability to have a responsive and seamless service without duplicating efforts and doing it in a very cost-effective manner. The OR21 representatives, George and Elizal, have been guiding us through our business planning process. If we can identify funding to put some of the basic database infrastructure in place, we could have 211 service up and running in our two counties by the first of next year. Our plan is then to bring on other Southern Oregon counties as partners when those areas are ready to join us. This legislation allows Oregon to build on the great efforts already put forth by the partners in the OR211 effort to date. much work has already been done and new services are on the horizon. So I ask that you support H. Bill 3443 as amended so that Oregon can continue moving forward towards the reality of a statewide 211 system. I'm willing to answer the question.
Thank you, Michael. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fieldman, my question is, I've got two questions, and one I'd like to direct to you directly, and the other would be relative to the whole 211 program. In Douglas County, you've got a significant presence and some very active, actively involved folks in the Cow Creek Band of the Umpquas. Yes. Do they participate with you? Have they been invited to take part in your program?
Yes, they have. In fact, that's part of the way we've been able to keep the warm line afloat is from grants that we've received from the foundation there. And they've been very supportive, very helpful of us. In fact, I don't think we would still be going without their support.
Excellent. I'm pleased to hear because they are excellent community partners.
Yes, they are.
Whoever they're in business. The second question I have is more broad-based, and that is relative to the 211, is there any internet connection that can put folks through if they've got broadband access? What's the next level of service in 211?
For us locally, we're doing everything on flip cards right now. That's the value of coming on with 211. If we can get funding, we're actually going to be able to get computerized and bring us into the modern age with it. But with 211, as I understand, I know elsewhere in the country, there is online access to that information also, and that so people can actually access that information directly and live. I want to respond to that better than I can.
Thank you.
Definitely. It's a great question. There are several other websites. Most 211s have their database on the web, and that's certainly the focus for 211 info. If you log on to the Community Action Agency in Washington County, they have what's called the FIND database, so you can, for example, go to H, click H for housing, and find out who does housing in those different areas.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? And do you have access to the number of hits that you're receiving?
I can get that for you from Washington County, certainly.
Great. Thank you very kindly. Mr. Chair, I think that's an excellent addition to this whole process, is to make sure that we take a look into the next century far enough that not just the phone lines are accessed, but also computer-based access.
Actually, even this century, wouldn't you guess?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Well, if I can just add one last piece on that. We've done a tremendous amount of work with several different websites, exactly to your point, that's sort of the trend of how people are finding information.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a site called OregonHelps.org, which is an eligibility estimator, the Beehive, which is a content site, and Housing Connections, which is a place for people to go find low-income housing. So at every stage possible, we have tried to partner with them to do outreach together, to put links to each other's sites together, so that the client can just go to one site and kind of get this door open to all the different resources. So that's really the trend of how we're trying to build the system.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I personally believe that probably would create the additional kinds of revenue sources to have folks be able to hot link those and then be able to advertise, if you will, on those particular places as well, so that this creates an additional income source, and then it also lets folks know, it'd be interesting to know the number of hits that you've received, but that substantially lowers your overall cost, obviously, by not having the additional incoming phone lines, not having the additional warm bodies that are there to have to service this. And again, Mr. Fielding, I appreciate your testimony on behalf of the Cow Creek Band of the Umpquas. They are an excellent community partner. I wish I had three or four of those kind, in addition to the one tribe that we have represented.
And just for your information, Martha Young, who's the executive director of the foundation, used to be the executive director at UCAN years ago. So.
Great.
So we have a great relationship.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3443 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2024. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2024 is requiring that at least 10% of the monies paid into the tobacco settlement funds account be used for tobacco education and prevention programs. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. You will notice that we have a -1 amendment attached to your SMS. And I also have given you, I believe, and if not, I'm doing it right now, just a hand engrossed of that one sentence change. This too has subsequently referral to Ways and Means, and I believe the amendment is to try and minimize the fiscal impact to that referral.
Okay, thanks. Gretchen Morley and Representative Carolyn Somay.
Yeah.
morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to testify. For the record, I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I'll wait for our little guys over here on the left. Thank you. I didn't intend to testify this morning, Mr. Chair, but I decided to because this is really an important issue for me. My mother-in-law died from lung cancer. And if any of you have seen someone die from lung cancer, it is not an easy way to die. She started smoking when she was very young. When the tobacco industry was advertising cigarettes, I still have copies of those ads where physicians would be advertising about cigarettes and what a safe and even healthful product they were, and they would be wearing their white coats that they wore in their clinics with a stethoscope around their necks. So when she started smoking many years ago, she was a young woman, and she did not realize how dangerous cigarettes were. Also, some of you know that I worked in the public schools as a child development specialist, and one of the things I did there was teach a class to small groups of children about the dangers of all kinds of drugs. And so we taught refusal skills. There was a whole kit that was provided by the state at that time that was funded through the funds that we're going to be talking about today. This was some 15 years ago. Those funds are no longer available. And child development specialists are seldom funded in public schools, so there is no one in the public schools now that I know of that are teaching, or at least very few people, teaching the kinds of refusal skills and the trying to encourage children to look at advertising. At that time, I think some of this advertising is no longer allowed, but at that time there were ads in very popular magazines. There were ads for cigarettes. Remember Joe Camel? And I would have the kids bring those ads to school and ask them to look at those and what were the messages they got just from looking at those ads. And they would show happy people at parties having a wonderful time. So the message the children got from that was, if I smoked, I could be one of these young people having a wonderful time at this party. So these are very subtle messages that the kids get. I think, and I hope, that those ads are no longer allowed in magazines. Certainly not access to. But because of that, I'm here to testify today in support of this bill and just to raise our awareness on how these programs do aid our children on acknowledging, be aware of the dangers of tobacco use, and hopefully create their ability to say no to tobacco. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Butler, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Tomei's testimony. It just reminded me of a story that was told in my youth about collecting the Lucky Strike wrappers. And
yes.
If you got 50,000 of those wrappers, you get a free iron lung.
Bad. Very bad. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment as well. I think each of us can reach back into his and her experience in this and find a loved one who, my father died from end-stage COPD after being a smoker his whole life until he was diagnosed, and then saying, that was easy to quit. I should have quit earlier. But, I mean, each of us have this personal link to this very terrible problem, so I really want to thank you for sharing yours.
Thank you, Representative.
Thanks. Gretchen.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this morning. For the record, my name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. The commission, as you may know, was created in 2003 with a broad charter to develop a plan for and monitor the implementation of the state's health policy. We are lucky enough, actually, to have two members of this committee as new legislative members on the commission, both Representative Dalto and Representative Greenlee. House Bill 2024 was introduced at the request of the commission in the context of a larger proposed framework to improve framework for the state's health policy. This larger framework was presented to the legislature in September 2004. Copies are available of that presentation if you don't have that, and it's also available on the Health Policy Commission website. The commission joins those who encourage funding for tobacco education and cessation efforts. Supporting this programming is one strategy in the commission's proposals to improve the health status of all Oregonians, along with activities that would improve physical activity, nutrition, reduce obesity, improve oral health. Additionally, though, the commission does understand the difficult task that is ahead for the legislature in terms of weighing priorities within a fixed amount of funds. The commission recognizes that many of the drivers of higher health care costs incurred by both the private and the public sectors are directly related to lifestyles that we are choosing voluntarily. Tobacco use cost Oregonians approximately $1.8 billion in 2000 in both direct medical expenditures and indirect costs due to lost productivity. Within this context, it is very important for the state to maintain the legislative recognition that smoking is one of the most detrimental health habits, one that even affects people who do not engage in it and is pervasive through all segments of our society. At a fundamental level, the commission believes that funding effective tobacco cessation education efforts will result in improved health status of Oregonians and decreased health care costs. We respectfully request your consideration of House Bill 2024, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thanks very much, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just one question relative to the lines 14 and 15. Directly, 10% of the money is paid to the account each biennium. Is that 10% after the current bond debt service, or is that 10% before?
Well, I think I would actually leave that question to, say, legislative fiscal in terms of the order in which funding would need to come out of the fund. My understanding is very basic in terms of what the funding is currently being used for. So.
Mr. Chair, I just expressed concern that I think that we've used up most of our capacity in the MSA for the purposes of the $400-plus million of bonds that we took out last session. And during the special sessions, and my concern is that a 10% amount may not yet be available. I think we used to within 92% of our total capacity, and unless our MSA receipts are substantially enhanced, we may not have 10% anymore. But that's just a question for fiscal.
Well, we'll just borrow your credit card, Representative Butler.
You bet. You bet. I have one of those plutonium cards. It sits in my wallet and smokes.
All right, Gretchen, thanks very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to comment and thank you for coming forward with this bill, and thank Representative Tomei for her testimony, too. And I think it's inherent on us as a committee and as a body, this legislature, to support this kind of legislation as a prevention measure, because everything we can do in treatment and all that is one thing, but to do as much as we can to prevent the problem in the first place will eventually save money and be the lesser of the costs. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Boone. John Valley.
It says you're sitting in the middle.
Where is that true?
Good morning, Chairman Dalto, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is John Valley. I'm the Government Affairs Director here in Oregon for the American Heart Association. And I've also been a member of the Health Status Work Group with the Oregon Health Policy Commission and helped sort of put this proposal together. Just to start off, before I get into my written testimony, I thought I'd address Representative Butler's question about the percentage. I think the expectation was, and there is some information that's being passed out that explains how the overall Master Settlement Agreement payments have been sort of used to pay off bond debts, and that currently there's about $24 million unallocated, the last projection we saw. So we would potentially for this biennium be talking about 10%, at least that's the expectation, I think, of 10% of that $24 million, so about 2.4 for this biennium. But hopefully over time, some of that debt service on those bonds will be paid off. I think the first will be done in 2013 for the OHSU bonds. Legislative fiscal would probably give you a much more detailed explanation of how that will work, but I think that's that's the expectation as this progresses. Hopefully over time, though, we see more money going to the tobacco prevention education program. The amendment that was referred to earlier is something that the Heart Association does support. What it does do is clarify where the money should be allocated to. It specifies the tobacco use reduction account, which is basically the account that created and now implements the statewide comprehensive tobacco prevention education program. In the bill, there was some vague language originally of where that money could be allocated to for tobacco prevention programs. We thought, and I'll elaborate this in my testimony, that the statewide tobacco prevention education program is a quality program based on CDC best practices. It has been proven effective over time, and we think it makes sense for the MSA money to go to that specific program, and that's what the amendment specifies. So with that being said, I will get into my written testimony. Back in 1998, Oregon joined 46 other states in signing the Master Settlement Agreement, or MSA, with the four largest tobacco companies in the United States. Internal tobacco company documents prove that tobacco companies were manipulating nicotine levels in cigarettes and targeting minors with their advertising. The primary reason for the initial lawsuit against the tobacco industry was to reduce the terrible toll that tobacco takes on Oregon by recovering some of the costs associated with tobacco-related illnesses and reducing those costs in the future. Unfortunately, the original intent behind the lawsuit and the MSA has been lost in recent years. Back in the year 2000, Oregonians rejected Measure 4 and Measure 89 because both measures failed to meet the intended purpose of the MSA. The measures allocated little or no MSA money to tobacco prevention efforts and helping people quit. The public understood that in order to reduce the state's costs associated with tobacco use and reverse the damage done by tobacco companies over several decades, money needed to be allocated in a meaningful way to prevention and cessation. Since the defeat of Measures 4 and 89, the MSA money has been seen as a windfall for the state to be used to plug up budget holes with no regard to the original intent of the lawsuit. To date, no MS money has been allocated to the state's comprehensive, effective tobacco prevention and education program, or TPEP. What we have seen are tobacco companies spending more and more money on advertising while states are spending less on tobacco prevention and cessation. In Oregon alone, the tobacco industry spends $383,288 per day on promotion and advertising. In response, Oregon has done the following. For one, in 2003, the Oregon legislature twice raided tobacco prevention and education program funding, which are voter-mandated funds, for a total of $14 million for general expenses in the Oregon Health Plan. The transfers actually closed TPEP from April through August 2003. TPEP did reopen in September 2003, but with a 70% budget cut. This past December in 2004, Governor Kulongoski recommended reallocating $10 million of voter-mandated funds out of TPEP, leaving TPEP to receive 1 cent of 3 cents mandated by voters with the passage of Measure 44 in 1996. Oregon, because of these policy changes, has slipped from among the top five states in spending on tobacco prevention in the late 1990s to 38th in 2005. Oregon faces many challenges during these difficult economic times, and the use of tobacco has contributed to the state's fiscal problems. Currently, 39% of the Oregon Health Plan clients smoke, double the rate for the rest of Oregon. Each year in Oregon, tobacco use claims about 7,000 lives and costs the state $871 million in direct health care expenditures. Smoking more than doubles the risk of a heart attack. The estimated cost of one heart attack is $23,234. The CDC recommends that Oregon should spend, at the minimum, $21.1 million per year for a comprehensive statewide tobacco control program. Oregon currently spends only $2.9 million per year. There is no doubt that smoking is the number one preventable cause of death and the number one public health issue facing Oregon. In Oregon, we have seen 75,000 fewer adult smokers and 42% fewer cigarettes consumed since the creation of TPEP back in 1996. However, such success is likely to disappear if we continue to defund TPEP. That is why we strongly support House Bill 2024 and the Policy Commission's efforts to address this important public health issue. Thank you again for allowing me to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions committee members may have.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, this isn't a question necessarily for John, but I, at some point we would need to find out how much, what our bond covenants are with regard to the state appropriation bonds and the OHSU bonds, because just the current debt service is probably not the covenant that we would allocate to funding those activities. So I think that question probably needs some additional follow-up.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Oh, Ms. Nass?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
John, I'm not sure that I'm seeing this in here. What is the current level funding for TPEP?
I believe right now it's about 5.1. I believe there's someone in DHS who might be able to give you the accurate number and how that money is.
5.1 million?
Is that in the current budget?
Good morning, Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei. I'm Karen Main. I'm the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program Manager for DHS. The current funding level for TPEP in the 03-05 biennium is $6.9 million.
Okay, may I follow up? Thank you. And so what is done with these funds? How do you use them?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, we work to have a comprehensive program addressing tobacco use in many different levels because it is such a complex issue, and as you spoke earlier, people are influenced in where they work, where they play, and the general community to use tobacco, and so we work to have a comprehensive program that addresses those issues in various ways. We work through communities, through local health departments. We work with multicultural organizations and networks. We work with the tribal communities. We have a statewide public awareness and education campaign. We run the state quit line for people who are looking to try to quit tobacco, to provide assistance for that. We have programs for schools. So we do try to address tobacco use in these various arenas because it is such a complicated and complex issue when people are influenced in various different ways.
I have one more follow-up. Thank you. So when the legislature took out $10 million, so what programs were cut out?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, the obviously going from having that amount of cuts affected all aspects of the tobacco prevention and education program. We, for example, we used to fund all 36 county health departments to have a local program being in their community, affecting the local policies at the local level, and currently we are only able to fund 13 counties throughout Oregon, and even those counties have a much reduced level of funding from before. Also, our very effective schools program took a devastating hit and was virtually scaled back to working through Department of Education for some tobacco policy work, but not the comprehensive presence in schools that was once so successful.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron?
Yeah, I'm not sure this is the appropriate place to get this question answered, but I had an email from a store owner in the local community that said they've witnessed people, is it Oregon Trail Card that DHS issues, but people on food stamps, or is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Credit card. Maybe you can maybe get back some information, but that they were able to refuse them to purchase cigarettes and alcohol on that, but they witnessed them go outside and be able to use that card and get cash out of an ATM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was in a bar in Edmonton on Friday. Inside the bar, there was an ATM machine with the Oregon Trail Card sticker on it.
And turn around and come back in and purchase cigarettes with the cash they got from this DHS card. Can you do some research on that and tell us what we're going to do to stop people from buying cigarettes with money we're doing already given DHS? I'd be interested to hear that and be able to get back to this store owner and say, what's the solution?
Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, will certainly look into that and get back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, all right, thanks very much. Pete Shepherd is the last person signed up
testify on this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I know that you've had a long agenda already this morning. I am taking up the tail end of the list here, so I'll be very brief. You've heard both this morning and on previous occasions a summary of the Master Settlement Agreement and the circumstances from which it arose. Suffice to say that the monetary portions of the Master Settlement Agreement reflected the enormous costs that are imposed on states by tobacco. In the report before you, we studied, we the Attorney General and a committee that he convened, we studied the question of kids and tobacco. Because, as you have already learned, we have a huge number of kids in Oregon who use tobacco, and unfortunately, many of those kids are going to become addicted and die prematurely as a consequence of their use of tobacco. In fact, one graphic image in my mind of the number of kids who use tobacco in Oregon is that there are more kids in Oregon who are regularly using tobacco today than would fit in all the seats in Autzen Stadium. So we studied those that issue in the report that you have before you, and made I think three key recommendations which are still relevant today. First, comprehensive tobacco control programs do work, and they're particularly effective with kids. Second, we found that this state needed to do much more even then in 2001 than we were doing then, and as you've already heard, we're doing less today than we were in 2001. And third, we recommended that Master Settlement Agreement funds be used to help enable the state to accomplish those first two goals, that Master Settlement Agreement funds be expended for those purposes. Regrettably, it hadn't happened at the time we had issued the report, and it hasn't happened since. Since the Master Settlement Agreement 7 years ago and since our report in 2001, Oregon has yet to spend really any of the Master Settlement Agreement money on comprehensive tobacco control programs. That remains a long-term goal and recommendation of the Attorney General. It's been so since the Master Settlement Agreement was entered into. If the other demands on the resources of the Assembly this session don't permit it to enact 2024 for the upcoming biennium, then it still would be the Attorney General's recommendation that the Assembly ought to do so for the next biennium. And if the Assembly doesn't do so next biennium, then it ought to do so the following biennium, and so on, because the demand for this is so important and has such a huge impact on our kids.
Okay. Questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, I know time is long spent, but my concern is I thought we had spent some of the early money into the TURA that came from this, and aren't we in effect through the Department of Human Services testimony is that we're spending $6.9 million presently in the Tobacco Prevention Education Program, even though it's general fund, not from the MSA, we are in effect funding those monies from one place or another.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, these are real dollars that are coming from the Master Settlement Agreement. This week, I think the payment is due for this year, and I think it's going to be around $65 million. Those are unrestricted monies, and as you indicate, those monies have been expended by the state for a variety of purposes, including some health system purposes. I guess our point is, and continuously has been, that the origination of these, the reason these dollars exist at all is because of the ravages that tobacco work on our kids and on our health system. And to date, the state has not dedicated any of those funds. As you say, it's certainly true that those resources are available and presumably have been available to offset other costs in the system, but they have not been dedicated to this purpose.
Thank you.
Real quick, Chair Galt, I wanted to clarify, if I heard
your name again.
Oh, John Valley with the Heart Association, is that the current funding for the Tobacco Prevention Education Program doesn't come from general fund dollars at all. It comes from Measure 44, a 30-cent cigarette tax, which was passed back in 1996. 10% of those funds have specifically been allocated to TURA. So there has not been any general fund dollars used for the tobacco prevention program, nor any Master Settlement Agreement money directed to that account. So just to clarify that, there hasn't been any general fund dollars for the program at all to this date.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative May.
So am I hearing that none of the master settlement agreement that we got is used for any kind of prevention program? Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, and that's one of the reasons we're, you know, talking about this bill today. If you go to a lot of, and Vice Chair Tomei and Representative Dalto, most people, if you talk to on the street and you say, remember that big master settlement agreement we have with the tobacco companies, how much do you think is that going to tobacco prevention education? No one says zero. There's this sort of understanding that people think that money has been used for that, when actually it hasn't. In other states, they've done it, but not here.
It's not just the people in the street. It's people in this
city.
It's people in this building.
That's the point.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Dalto?
Yes,
Representative. One last question. Then where, what, how is this money being used?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, there are others who are more expert about the entire downstream payments, but there are several things that it's being used for. One is it's being used to help Oregon enforce the non-participating manufacturer statutes, because those statutes, diligent enforcement of those statutes is a condition of our continued receipt of the money. That's one purpose. A very small part of the total is used for that. Then it's paid into a particular account, which is referenced in the bill. The goes into the tobacco settlement funds account, and then from that account, a certain portion is used to pay the cost of the bonds that have been referred to earlier. And then the balance, it's my understanding, and again, this is the piece that others would be more expert on, it's my understanding that the balance of the resources are used to support the Oregon Medical Assistance Program, OMAP.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing and adjourn the meeting.